Side 8, The Hidden City, The Tomilee Book 3, by David Eddings, continuing on page 259. Kling frowned.
You might want to have a talk with Sparhawk, friend Vanyan, he said. I enjoy a good fight as much as the next man, but if he's going to declare war on the whole universe, he ought to let the rest of us in on his plan.
I'll definitely speak with him about it, Domi Kling, Vanyan said. Then he sighed. I wish we'd known more about Klell's soldiers earlier. The Church Knights encountered them in the mountains of Zemot and lost half their number in killed and wounded.
I'm sorry, friend Vanyan. Did you lose many old comrades?
Many, Domi Kring, Vanyan replied sadly. Many.
How's friend Engessa coming along? Kring asked Betwana.
Afriel says that he's recovering, Domi, she replied. I'd like to see that for myself, though.
Itanya returned, accompanied by a Tamil wearing slightly out-of-date clothing.
Would you please see to it that we're not disturbed? He said to the Eitan guard in the hall.
Then he closed and bolted the door.
I have some good news for a change, he said then.
He put his hand on the stranger's shoulder.
This is my very dear, though new-found friend, Ecclesius, he said.
Petwana frowned.
That is not a Tamil name, she said.
No, Your Majesty, Itanya agreed. It's not. Actually, it's Delphaic. The Delphae are such a musical people. It probably derives from the fact that they still speak classical Tamil. My friend here just stopped by to advise us that the Delphae have decided to come out of their splendid seclusion. Ecclesius, this is Preceptor Vanyan, the close friend of Annika. The regal lady is Betwana, queen of the Aetons. The short fellow is Domi Kring of the Western Poloi. The tall, pretty girl with the death grip on his hand is Mirtai, his betrothed. And the exquisite Styric lady is Sophrenia, high priestess of the goddess Afriel.
Nobles all, Ecclesius greeted them with a formal bow. I bring greetings from beloved Edamus. Divine Afriel hath persuaded him that we have common cause in the current situation, and he hath thus relaxed his centuries-old prohibition upon us. I am sent to thee, Lord Vanyan, to advise thee that I and diverse companions are at thine immediate disposal. Where might we best be deployed to further our cause?
If I may, Lord Vanyan, Itanya interposed, it just occurred to me that the Delphae might be best suited to empty those ruins in the Arjunai jungles. If Ecclesius and his friends were to appear in all their glowing splendor at the gates of Scarpa's camps down there, the rebels would probably go back home and take up peaceful pursuits just as fast as they possibly could.
Well said, Mirtai murmured her agreement.
He certainly moves around, doesn't he?
Ulof said to Tinian, as the beer wagon with Sparhawk and Calton perched atop the barrels rumbled past on the ancient street.
Last I heard, he was in Dirgis.
The natural rules don't seem to apply to old Sparhawk, Tinian replied in a bad imitation of Kaalador's dialect. What do you think? Should we slip back into real time, or should we stay where we are?
I think we'll be more useful if we stay out of sight,
Ulof replied.
That's fine with me, but how are we going to get word to Sparhawk and the others that we're here?
I'll slip a note in his pocket, or blow in his ear.
That ought to get his attention.
Blockus came shambling back up the street with a mournful expression on his ape-like face.
There are no dogs here, he reported in Trollish.
Soldiers don't usually keep dogs, Blockus, Tinian explained.
I have hunger, Tinian. Would the man things here miss one of their herd? A small one?
We might have a problem here, Tinian muttered to Ulof. It's definitely in our best interest to keep our friend here well fed.
Ulof scratched at his now clean-shaven cheek.
We can't just turn him loose, he noted. He'll attract attention if he starts grabbing people and jerking them into these broken moments.
He's invisible, Ulof.
Yes, but if some Arjunai suddenly vanishes and his bones start getting tossed back out of nowhere,
It's bound to attract attention.
He turned back to the troll.
It is our thought that it would not be good for you to kill and eat the man-things here, Blockus. We hunt thought here, and if you kill and eat the man-things, you will frighten the thought away.
I do not like this hunting of thought, Ulat, Blockus complained. It makes things not simple.
The forest is near, Blockus, Tinian said. There must be many good-to-eat things there.
I am not an ogre, Tinian,
Blockus protested in a slightly offended tone.
I do not eat trees.
There should be creatures that are good to eat among the trees, Blockus, Ulat said. That is what Tinian was trying to say. It was not his thought to insult you.
Blockus glowered at Tinian for a moment.
I will go hunt now, he said abruptly.
Then he turned and shambled off.
You have to be careful, Tinian, Ulat warned his friend. If you want to get into a fight almost immediately, all you have to do is suggest to a troll that he might be an ogre.
They're actually prejudiced? Tinian asked in amazement.
You wouldn't believe how prejudiced, Ulat replied. Trolls and ogres have hated each other since the beginning of time.
I thought that prejudice was a human failing.
Some things are just too good to stay private, I guess. Let's follow Sparhawk and let him know that we're here. He might have something for us to do.
They trailed along behind the beer caravan, winding through the cleared streets, toward that part of Natayos that was still choked in brush and vines. The wagons trundled along a recently cleared street, and then went around behind a canvas-roofed building identified by a crudely lettered sign that read, Senga's.
Trust Carlton to get close to the beer, Tinian said.
Truly, Ulat agreed. Wait here. I'll go let Sparhawk know that we're in the Tios.
He walked over to where Sparhawk, Carlton, and Bevier, looking strange with their altered features, stood off to one side, while Senga supervised the unloading of the barrels.
Ram's horn, he said quietly. Don't get excited and start looking around, he added. You won't be able to see me.
Ulat? Carlton asked incredulously.
Right. Tinian, Blockus, and I got here yesterday. We've been nosing around.
How have you managed to become invisible? The patch-eyed Bevier asked.
We aren't, actually. Gnome's breaking the seconds into two pieces. We're only present during the smaller piece. That's why you can't see us.
But you can see us?
Yes.
Ulat, that's logically inconsistent.
I know. But Gnome believes that it works, and I guess his belief is strong enough to override logic. Tinian and I are here, and nobody can see us. Is there anything you want us to do?
Can you get into that building near the gate? Sparhawk asked quickly.
The one with the barred windows? Not a chance. We already looked into the possibility. Too many guards on the doors. Blockus even tried going in through the roof. But it's all sealed up. That's my wife in there, Ulat, Sparhawk exclaimed. Are you saying that you tried to send a troll into the same building with her? Blockus wouldn't have hurt her, Sparhawk. Frightened her a little, maybe, but he wouldn't have hurt her. We sort of thought he might be able to go in through the roof, pick Elana and Aileen up, and carry them out.
Ulat paused.
It wasn't really our idea, Sparhawk. Blockus volunteered. Well, actually, he didn't even volunteer. He just started climbing up the wall before we could stop him. He said, I will go get them. I will bring Annika's mate and her friend out so that we can kill all these children of Sirgon and eat them. Blockus a little elemental, but his heart's in the right place. I hate to admit it, but I'm actually starting to like him.
Carlton looked around nervously.
Where is he now? He asked. He's out hunting. When we were knocking around those cities by the lake, we persuaded him not to eat people. We got him started on dogs instead. He really likes them, but there aren't any dogs here in the Tios, so he's out in the woods, probably chasing elephants or something.
Then something flickered at the corner of Ulat's eye.
What in God's name is that? He exclaimed.
What? Carlton asked, looking around in bafflement.
There's somebody made out of rainbows coming around the side of the building,
Uloth gaped at the clearly defined shape approaching. The many-colored light was dazzling.
"That's Zamisha," Sparhawk explained. "Can you actually see her? Are you saying that you can't?"
"She's invisible, Uloth."
"Not to me, she isn't."
"It must have something to do with the peculiar time you're in, my friend," Bevier suggested. "You'd better let her know that you can see her. It might be important someday." The shimmering rainbow stopped a few paces away.
"Annika,"
Zamisha said softly.
"I hear thee, Anaray," Sparhawk replied.
"It pains me to tell thee that I have failed," she confessed. "The mind of Scarpa is so twisted that I cannot wring coherence from his thought. I did gently probe the minds of some of his followers, however, and I must sadly advise thee that thy queen is no longer here in the Taios. When our enemies did discover the subterfuge involving young Sir Barrett, Zelasta did spirit thy wife and her handmaiden away under cover of darkness. I shall endeavor to glean their destination from the thoughts of others here, and it please thee."
Uloth's heart twisted with sympathy at the look of sudden despair that came over Sparhawk's face. They ran easily in their endless regiments, tall and lightly armored, with their bronze limbs glowing in the cool gray light. The towering King Andril ran smoothly at the front of his army. It was good to be on the move again, and the prospect of battle was exhilarating. Battle was meaningful, and one could actually see results. The absence of his wife had thrust a thousand petty administrative chores on Andril's unprepared shoulders. It was so frustrating to make decisions about things he didn't really understand, and even more frustrating not to see any immediate results that would have told him whether or not his decisions had been correct. Once again, the King of Aton thanked his god for giving him Betwana to wife. They made a good team, actually. The queen was very skilled with details. Her mind was quick, and she could pick out subtleties and nuances that frequently escaped her husband. Andril, on the other hand, was made for action. He gladly let his wife make all the tiresome decisions. And then, when it was all settled and they knew what they were going to do, he took charge of carrying her decisions out. It was better that way, actually. The King of Aton was fully aware of his limitations, and he knew that his wife forgave him when he occasionally overlooked something. He hoped that he didn't disappoint her too much. Her suggestion, she never gave him orders, that he take the bulk of their people to the south end of Lake Sarna in preparation for a grand battle at Tosa, was exactly the sort of thing Andril truly loved. Here was action, simple and uncomplicated. The troublesome decisions had all been made, the enemy had been identified, and all the boring details had been swept out of the way. He smiled as he led his army into the last outcropping of mountains, some 50 leagues to the southeast of Tualis. Betwana's message had hinted that the battle at Tosa would be a titanic one, a grand clash at arms with struggling armies stretching for miles, and the ring of sword against sword reaching to the skies. He would make her proud of him. The route through the outcropping mountains led up a long ridgeline, through a narrow notch, and then down into the deep gorge of a turbulent stream that had gnawed at the rock for eons. King Andril was breathing a bit heavily when he crested the ridgeline and led his forces through the notch. The wasted hours spent conferring with Ambassador Norcan had taken off Andril's edge. A warrior should never permit himself to be lured away from the practice field or the exercise yard. He picked up the pace as he led his army down into the narrow gorge, running smoothly along the south bank of the rushing mountain river. If he was out of shape, his soldiers probably were as well. He hoped that he could find a suitable place for an encampment at Lake Sarna, a proper encampment with enough space for training and practice and those necessary calisthenics that honed warriors to the peak of fitness. Andril was sublimely confident that any opposing force could be overcome if only his army were fully trained and fit.
"Andril King," General Pemos shouted over the sound of the turbulent stream. "Look!"
"Where?"
Andril demanded, half turning and reaching for his sword.
"At the top of the gorge, on the right."
The Aton King craned his neck to peer up the sheer cliff face to the rocky brink high above. The King of Aton had seen many things in his life, but nothing to compare with the vast,
monstrous form rearing suddenly above them on the rim of the gorge. The thing was glossy black, like polished leather, and it had enormously outspreading wings, jointed and bat-like. Its wedge-shaped head was accentuated by blazing eye-slits and a gaping mouth that dripped flame. King Andril considered it. The problem, of course, was the fact that the towering creature was at the top of the gorge, while he stood at the bottom. He could turn and retrace his steps, running back up the gorge to the notch and scrambling around the rocks to reach the rim. But that would give the thing plenty of opportunity to run away, and then he would have to chase it down in order to kill it. In his present less-than-perfect condition, that would be very tedious. He could always climb up the cliff, but that would still take time, and the creature might very well see him coming and try to flee. Then, amazingly, the large being at the top of the gorge provided the solution. It raised its enormous arms and began to slash at the top of the cliff with what appeared to be fire of some kind. Andril smiled as the cliff face began to topple outward, tumbling and roaring down into the gorge. The silly beast was accommodatingly providing the means for its own destruction. How could it be so stupid? King Andril adroitly dodged the tumbling, house-sized boulder, carefully assessing the rapidly growing slope of rubble piling up at the base of the cliff. The beast actually intended to attack. Andril laughed with delight. The creature was stupid beyond imagining, but he did have to give it credit for courage. Foolish courage, of course, but courage nonetheless. All the universe knew that Andril of Aton was invincible, and yet this poor dumb brute meant to pit its puny strength against the greatest warrior since the beginning of time. Andril looked speculatively at the steep, growing slope of rubble, ignoring the cries of those of his soldiers not nimble enough to avoid being crushed in the avalanche rumbling down upon them. Almost high enough now, just a few more feet. And then he judged that the steep slope had grown high enough to give him access to the stupid creature roaring and flapping its wings high above. He dodged another boulder and began his rush, scrambling, dodging, leaping, as he swiftly mounted toward the doomed beast above him. When he was almost to the top, he paused, drew his sword, and set himself. And then, with a savage war cry, he rushed up the remaining slope, ignoring the momentary flicker of sympathy he felt for the brave, misguided creature he was about to kill.
"Where do you think you're going?"
A burly Dacite, wearing a shabby uniform tunic and holding a long pike, demanded as Sparhawk and Calton pulled the wobbly cart with two large barrels in it around the corner of the building.
"We've got a delivery from Senga for Master Krager," Calton replied.
"Anybody could say that."
"Go ask him," Calton suggested.
"I wouldn't want to disturb him."
"Then you'd better let us pass. He's been waiting for this wine for quite some time now. If you keep us from delivering it, he'll really be disturbed. He might even be disturbed enough to take the matter to Lord Scarpa."
The guard's face grew apprehensive.
"Wait here,"
he said, then turned and went along the back of the building to the heavy door.
"I'll stay in the background when we get inside," Sparhawk quietly told his friend. "If he asks, just tell him that I'm a strong back you commandeered to help pull the cart."
Calton nodded.
"Are you here, Anaray?"
Sparhawk asked, looking around in spite of the fact that he knew he wouldn't be able to see her.
"Right at thy side, Annika,"
her voice replied softly.
"We'll keep him talking for as long as we can. He'll probably be a little drunk. Will that make it difficult for you?"
"I have shared the thoughts of this Krager before,"
she told him.
"He is coherent unless he is far gone with drink. If it be convenient, direct his attention toward the house where thy queen was late held captive. That may prod his mind toward thoughts of interest to us."
"I'll see what I can do, Anaray," Calton promised.
The Dacite guard came back.
"He'll receive you,"
he announced.
"Somehow I was almost sure he would."
Calton smirked.
"Master Krager's very fond of this particular wine."
He and Sparhawk lifted the shafts of the cart and pulled it along over the rough, littered ground at the back of the semi-restored ruin that appeared to be Scarpa's main headquarters. Krager was eagerly waiting in the doorway. His head was shaved, but he still looked much the same. He was disheveled and unshaven. His nearsighted, watery eyes were bloodshot, and his hands were visibly shaking.
"Bring it inside," he ordered in his familiar, rusty-sounding voice.
Colton and Sparhawk set the shafts of the cart down, untied the ropes that had held the two barrels in place, and carefully eased one of them out onto the ground. Colton measured the height of the barrel with the length of the rope, and then checked the width of the doorway.
"Just barely," he said. "Tip it over, Fran. We'll be able to roll it in."
Sparhawk heaved the barrel over onto its side, and he and his friend rolled it through the doorway into the cluttered room beyond. There was an unmade bed against one wall, and clothes littered the floor. The place was permeated with the acrid smell of Krager's unwashed, wine-sodden body, and there was a heap of empty casks and broken earthenware bottles in one corner.
"Where did you want these, Master Krager?" Colton asked.
"Any place," Krager said impatiently.
"That's not thinking ahead," Colton said critically. "They're too heavy for you to move by yourself. Pick a spot that'll be convenient."
"You might be right."
Krager squinted around the room. Then he went to a place near the head of the bed and kicked some clothes out of the way.
"Put them right here," he instructed.
Before we go any further, why don't we settle up? These are very expensive, Master Krager."
"How much?"
"Senga told me that he had to have 50 crowns a barrel. Archean red's very hard to come by this far away from Archean."
50 crowns? Krager exclaimed.
"Each," Colton insisted. "He told me to open the barrels for you, too."
"I know how to open a wine barrel, Carl."
"I'm sure of it. But Senga's an honest businessman, and he wants me to make sure you're satisfied before I take your money."
He rolled the barrel over against the wall.
"Help me set it up, Fran," he told Sparhawk.
They righted the barrel, and Colton took a pry bar out from under his belt.
"Beer's a lot easier to deal with," he noted. "Somebody ought to tell those Archean vintners about the advantages of putting a bunghole in the side of a barrel."
He carefully pried up the lid as Krager, cup in hand, eagerly waited at his elbow.
"Give it a try, Master Krager," Colton said then, lifting off the lid and stepping aside.
Krager dipped his cup into the deep red liquid, lifted it with a trembling hand, and drank deeply.
"Marvelous," he sighed happily.
"I'll tell Senga that it meets with your approval," Colton said.
He laughed.
"You wouldn't expect it of a highway robber, but Senga's very concerned about satisfying his customers. Would you believe that he even had us pour out a barrel of beer that had gone sour? Come on, Fran, let's get the other barrel. We'll have Master Krager test that one, and then we'll settle accounts."
The two of them went back outside and manhandled the second barrel out of the cart. "Ask him why they've taken the guards off the doors of the house where they were holding Alana and Aileen," Sparhawk muttered.
"Right,"
Colton grunted as they lowered the wine barrel to the ground. They put the second barrel beside the first. Colton pried open the lid, and Krager sampled it.
"Satisfactory?" Colton asked.
"Just fine," Krager said.
He dipped out another cup and sank back happily on his bed.
"Absolutely splendid.
That'll be 100 crowns then."
Krager pulled a heavy purse out from under his belt and negligently tossed it to Colton.
"Here," he said. "Count it out yourself. Don't steal too much."
"This is business, Master Krager," Colton told him. "If I was robbing you, I'd have my knife against your throat."
He swept some clothing and a few dried crusts of bread off the top of a table with his forearm, opened the purse, and started counting out coins.
"We noticed that all the guards have been pulled away from the house with the bars on the windows," he said.
"A couple of days ago, a man couldn't get within 20 paces of that place. But this morning, Fran and I wheeled that cart right past the front door, and nobody paid any attention to us. Has Lord Scarpham moved whatever was so valuable out of there?"
Krager's puffy face became suddenly alert. "That's none of your business, Carl."
"I didn't say it was. You might just make a suggestion to Lord Scarpa, though. If he doesn't want people to notice things like that, he shouldn't change anything. He should have kept all the guards right where they were. Senga and the rest of us are all robbers, you know, and we all more or less believed that Lord Scarpa was keeping his treasure in that house. The word treasure makes men like us prick up our ears." Krager stared at him, and then he began to laugh. "What's so funny?" Colton looked up from his counting.
"It was a treasure, all right, Carl," Krager smirked, "but not the kind you can count.
Like you say, it's none of my business, but every man who works in Senga's Tavern knows that it's been moved. I'm sure they'll all be poking around in these ruins looking for the new storehouse."
"Let them look," Krager shrugged. "The treasure's a long, long way from here by now."
"I hope you've still got guards on it. Those woods out there are crawling with fellows like Fran and me. Would you come here and check my count?"
"I trust you, Carl."
"You're a fool, then."
"Take another 10 crowns for yourself and your man," Krager said expansively. "And then, if you don't mind, I'd like to be alone with my 2 new friends here."
"You're very generous, Master Krager." Colton took some more coins from the purse, scooped up all the ones he had previously counted out, and dumped them into the side pocket of his smock. "Let's go, Fran," he said to Sparhawk. "Master Krager wants to be alone."
"Tell Senga that I'm grateful to him," Krager said, sipping out more wine. "And tell him to keep his eye out for more of this excellent vintage. I'll buy all he can find."
"I'll tell him, Master Krager. Enjoy yourself." And Colton led the way out of the reeking room. Sparhawk closed the door and held out his hand.
"What?"
Colton asked. "My 5 crowns, if you don't mind," Sparhawk said firmly. "Let's keep accounts current, shall we?"
"Thou art shrewd, Sir Colton," Zenisha's whispered voice came to them. "Thou didst most skillfully guide his thought in precisely the direction most useful to us."
Colton made some show of counting coins into Sparhawk's hand. "What did you find out, Anaray?" he asked in a tense voice.
"Some day or two ago, a closed carriage did depart from this place, after making some show of stopping, under heavy guard, at the door to the house upon which all our attention had been fixed. The carriage, which was but a ploy, is bound for Panandia. Those we seek are not inside, however. They had long since departed from the Taios with Zelasta."
"Did Krager know where Zelasta was taking them?" Sparhawk asked.
"It was evidently in Zelasta's mind that none here should know,"
Zenisha replied.
"But Krager, ever alert to the main chance, was well aware that news of Zelasta's destination might well save his life should things go awry, and he did strive most assiduously to learn the Styric's plans. By feigning drunken stupor, he was able to be present when Zelasta did speak with his comrade, Cezada. The twain spoke in Styric, but Krager, unbeknownst to us all, hath a smattering of that tongue, and he was thus able to glean from their hurried conversation the very information which he, and we, are most curious about."
"That's a surprise," Colton muttered. "Drunk or sober, Krager's a shrewd one, all right. Where's Zelasta taking the ladies, Anaray?" Zenisha sighed.
"The information is melancholy, Sir Colton," she told him. "I do fear me that it is Zelasta's intent to take the queen and her handmaiden to the hidden city of Sirga, where Sirgon himself doth hold sway, and by his power there can deny us all access to those we love."
Part 3. Sirga. Chapter 20. If they would just let her sleep. The world around her seemed distorted, unreal, and she could only watch in numb, uncaring bemusement as her exhausted body screamed for sleep, or even for death. She stood exhausted at the window. The slaves, toiling in the fields around the lake below, looked almost like ants crawling across the winter fallow fields as they grubbed at the soil with crude implements. Other slaves gathered firewood among the trees on the sloping sides of the basin, and the puny sounds of their axes drifted up to the dark tower from which she watched. Aelin lay on an unpadded bench. Sleeping or dead, Aelana could no longer tell which, but she envied her gentle maid in either case. They were not alone, of course. They were never alone. Zelasta, his own face gaunt with weariness, talked on and on with King Xanthiocles.
Elana was too tired to make any sense of the haggard Sirik's droning words. She absently looked at the king of the Sirgai, a man in a close-fitting steel breastplate, a short leather kirtle, and ornate steel wrist guards. Santhiocles was of a race apart, and generations of selective breeding had heightened those features most admired by his people. He was tall and superbly muscled. His skin was very fair, although his carefully curled and oiled hair and beard were glossy black. His nose was straight, continuing the unbroken line of his forehead. His eyes were very large and very dark, and totally empty. His expression was haughty, cruel. His was the face of a stupid, arrogant man, devoid of compassion or even simple decency. His ornate breastplate left his upper arms and shoulders bare, and as he listened, he absently clenched and relaxed his fists, setting his muscles to writhing and dancing under his pale skin. He was obviously not paying much attention to Zelasta's words, but sat instead totally engrossed in the rhythmic flexing and relaxing of the muscles in his arms. He was in all respects a perfect soldier, possessed of a superbly conditioned body and a mind unviolated by thought. Elana wearily let her eyes drift again around the room. The furniture was strange. There were no chairs as such, only benches and padded stools with ornate arms, but no backs. Evidently the notion of a chair back had not occurred to the Sirgai. The table in the center of the room was awkwardly low, and the lamps were of an ancient design, no more than hammered copper bowls of oil with burning wicks floating in them. The roughly sawed boards of the floor were covered with rushes. The walls of square-cut black basalt were unadorned, and the windows were undraped. The door opened, and Akatis entered. Elana struggled to bring her exhausted mind into focus. Santhiocles was king here in Sirga, but it was Akatis who ruled. The high priest of Sirgon was robed and cowled in black, and his aged face was a network of deep wrinkles. Although his expression was every bit as cruel and arrogant as that of his king, his eyes were shrewd and ruthless. The front of his black robe was adorned with the symbol that seemed to be everywhere here in the Hidden City, a white square surmounted by a stylized golden flame. There was some significance to it, certainly, but Elana was too tired even to wonder what it might be. "Come with me," he commanded abruptly. "Bring the women." "The servant girl is of no moment," Zelasta replied in a slightly challenging tone. "Let her sleep." "I am not accustomed to having my commands questioned, Styric." "Get accustomed, Sirg. The women are my prisoners. My arrangement is with Sirgon, and you're no more than an appendage to that arrangement. Your arrogance is beginning to annoy me. Leave the girl alone." Their eyes locked, and a sudden tension filled the room. "Well, Akatis," Zelasta said very quietly, "has the time come? Have you finally worked up enough courage to challenge me?" "Any time, Akatis. Any time at all." Elana, now fully alert, saw the flicker of fear in the eyes of Sirgon's priest. "Bring the queen, then," he said sullenly. "It is she whom Sirgon would behold." "Wise decision, Akatis," Zelasta said sardonically. "If you keep making the right choices, you might even live for a little while longer." Elana took her cloak and gently covered Aileen with it. Then she turned to face the three men. "Let's get on with this," she told them, mustering some remnant of her royal manner. Santhiocles rose woodenly to his feet and put on his high-crested helmet, taking great pains to avoid mussing his carefully arranged hair. He spent several moments buckling on his large round shield, and then he drew his sword. "What an ass," Elana noted scornfully. "Are you really sure you should trust His Majesty with anything sharp? He might hurt himself with it, you know."
"It is customary, woman," Akatis replied stiffly. "Prisoners are always kept under close guard."
"Ah," she murmured, "and we must obey the dictates of custom, mustn't we, Akatis? When custom rules, thought is unnecessary."
Zelasta smiled faintly. "I believe you wanted to take us to the temple, Akatis. Let's not keep Sirgon waiting."
Akatis choked back a retort, jerked the door open, and led them out into the chilly hallway. The stairs that descended from the topmost tower of the royal palace were narrow and steep, endless stairs winding down and down. Elana was trembling by the time they reached the courtyard below. The winter sun was very bright in that broad courtyard, but there was not much heat to it. They crossed the flagstone courtyard to the pale temple, a building constructed not of marble, but of chalky limestone. Unlike marble, the limestone had a dull, unreflective surface, and the temple looked somehow diseased, leprous. They mounted the stairs to the portico and entered through a wide doorway. Elana had expected it to be dark inside this holy of holies, but it was not. She stared with a certain apprehensive astonishment at the source of the light, even as Akatis and Xanthiocles prostrated themselves, crying in unison, "Vanet Tiek Alcor, Yala Sirgan!" And then it was that the queen understood the significance of that ubiquitous emblem that marked virtually everything here in the hidden city. The white square represented the blocky altar, set in the precise center of the temple. But the flame that burned atop that altar was no stylized representation. It was instead an actual fire that twisted and flared, reaching hungrily upward. Elana was suddenly afraid. The fire burning on the altar was not some votive offering, but a living flame, conscious, aware, and possessed of an unquenchable will. Bright as the sun, Sirgan himself burned eternal on his pale altar. "No," Sparhawk decided. "We'd better not. Let's just sit tight, at least until Xanisha has the chance to winnow through a few minds. We can always come back and deal with Scarpa and his friends later. Right now, we need to know where Zalasta's taking Elana and Aileen." "We already know," Carlton said. "They're going to Sirga."
"That's the whole point," the now visible Ulof told him. "We don't know where Sirga is."
They had gone back into the vine-choked ruins and had gathered on the second floor of a semi-intact palace to consider options.
"Afriel has a general idea," Carlton said. "Can't we just start out for central Seneska and do some poking around when we get there?"
"I don't think that'd do much good," Bevier pointed out. "Sirgon's been concealing the place with illusions for the past 10 eons. We could probably walk right through the streets of the city and not even see it."
"He's not hiding it from everybody," Kaalador mused. "There are messages going back and forth, so somebody here in the Taios has to know the way."
"Sparhawk's right. Why don't we let Xanisha do the poking around here, instead of the lot of us going off into the desert to dodge scorpions and snakes while we turn over pebbles and grains of sand?"
"We stay here, then?" Tinian asked.
"For the time being," Sparhawk replied. "Let's not do anything to attract attention until we find out what Xanisha can discover. That's our best option at the moment."
"We were so close," Carlton fumed. "If we'd just gotten here a day or two earlier."
"Well, we didn't," Sparhawk said flatly, forcing back his own disappointment and frustration. "So let's salvage what we can."
"With Zalasta getting farther and farther away with every minute," Carlton added bitterly.
"Don't worry, Carlton," Sparhawk told him in a tone as cold as death. "Zalasta can't run far enough or fast enough to get away from me when I decide to go after him."
"Are you busy, Sarabian?"
Empress Elisun asked tentatively from the doorway of the blue-draped room. "Not really, Elisun," he sighed. "Just brooding. I've had a great deal of bad news in the last day or so."
"I'll come back some other time. You're not much fun when you've got things on your mind."
"Is that all there is in the world, Elisun?" he asked her sadly. "Only fun?" Her sunny expression tightened slightly, and she stepped into the room.
"That's what you married us for in the first place, wasn't it, Sarabian?"
She spoke in crisp Tamil that was not at all like her usual relaxed Valesian dialect.
"Our marriages to you were to cement political alliances, so we're here as symbols, playthings, and ornaments. We're certainly not a part of the government."
He was rather startled by her perception, and by the sudden change in her. It was easy to underestimate Elisun. Her single-minded pursuit of pleasure and the aggressively revealing nature of her native dress proclaimed her to be an empty-headed sensualist.
but this was a completely different Elisun. He looked at her with new interest.
"What have you been up to lately, my love?"
he asked her fondly.
"The usual."
She shrugged. He averted his eyes. "Please don't do that."
"Do what?"
"Bounce that way. It's very distracting."
"It's supposed to be. You didn't think I dressed this way because I'm too lazy to put on clothes, did you?"
"Is that why you came by, for fun? Or was there something more tedious?" They had never talked this way before, and her sudden frankness intrigued him.
"Let's talk about the tedious things first," she said.
She looked at him critically.
"You need to get more sleep,"
she chided. "I wish I could. I've got too much on my mind."
"I'll have to see what I can do about that."
She paused.
"There's something going on in the women's palace, Arabian."
"Oh?"
"A lot of strangers have been mingling with the assorted lapdogs and toadies that litter the halls."
He laughed. "That's a blunt way to describe courtiers."
"Aren't they? There's not a real man among them. They're in the palace to help us with our schemes. You did know that we spend our days plotting against each other, didn't you?"
He shrugged. "It gives you all something to do in your spare time."
"That's the only kind of time we have, my husband. All of our time is spare time, Sarabian. That's what's wrong with us. Anyway, these strangers aren't attached to any of the established courts."
"Are you sure?" Her answering smile was wicked.
"Trust me. I've had dealings with all the regular ones. They're all little more than butterflies. These strangers are wasps."
He gave her an amused look. "Have you actually winnowed your way through all the courtiers in the women's palace?"
"More or less."
She shrugged again. Quite deliberately, he thought.
"Actually, it was rather boring. Courtiers are a tepid lot. But it was a way to keep track of what was going on."
"Then it wasn't entirely..."
"A little, perhaps. But I have to take steps to protect myself. Our politics are subtle, but they're savage."
"Are these strangers Tamils?"
"Some are. Some aren't."
"How long has this been going on?"
"Since we all moved back to the women's palace. I didn't see any of these wasps when we were all living here with the Alines."
"Just the past few weeks, then?" She nodded.
"I thought you should know. It could be just more of the same kind of thing that's been going on for years. But I don't really think so. It feels different somehow. Our politics are more indirect than yours, and what's happening in the women's palace is men's politics."
"Do you suppose you could keep an eye on it for me? I'd be grateful."
"Of course, my husband. I am loyal, after all."
"Oh, really?"
"Don't make that mistake, Sarabian. Loyalty shouldn't be confused with that other business. That doesn't mean anything. Loyalty does."
"There's a lot more to you than meets the eye, Elisun."
"Oh? I've never tried to conceal anything."
She inhaled deeply. He laughed again. "Do you have plans for this evening?"
"Nothing that can't be put off until some other time. What did you have in mind?"
"I thought we might talk a while."
"Talk?"
"Among other things."
"Let me send a message first. Then we can talk for as long as you like. Among those other things you mentioned."
They were 2 days out of Tiana on their way around the west end of the lake on the road to Arjuna. They had camped on the lakeshore some distance from the road, and Khalad had shot a deer with his crossbow.
"Camp meat," he explained to Barrett as he skinned the animal. "It saves time and money."
"You're really very good with that crossbow," Barrett said. Khalad shrugged.
"Practice," he replied.
Then his head came up sharply.
"Company coming."
He pointed toward the road with his knife. "Arjuna," Barrett noted, squinting at the approaching riders.
"Not all of them," Khalad disagreed. "The one in front's an Aline, an Edomishman, judging from his clothes."
Khalad wiped his bloody hands on the long grass, picked up his crossbow, and recocked it.
"Just to be on the safe side," he explained. "They do know who we really are, after all."
Barrett nodded bleakly and loosened his sword in its scabbard. The riders reined in about 50 yards away.
"Sir Sparhawk?"
the Edomishman called out in the Lenik.
"Maybe,"
Barrett called back. "What can I do for you, neighbor?"
"I have a message for you."
"I'm touched. Bring it on in."
Come alone, Khalad added. You won't need your bodyguards.
I've heard about what you did to the last messenger.
Good, Khalad replied. We sort of intended for word of that to get around. The fellow had a little trouble being civil, but I'm sure you have better manners. Come ahead. You're safe, as long as you're polite.
The Domishman still hesitated.
Friend, Khalad said pointedly, you're well within range of my crossbow, so you'd better do as I tell you. Just come on in alone. We'll conduct our business, and then you and your Arjunai friends can be on your way. Otherwise, this might turn unpleasant.
The Domishman conferred briefly with his bodyguards, and then rode cautiously forward, holding a folded parchment above his head. I'm not armed, he announced.
That's not very prudent, neighbor, Barrett told him. These are troubled times. Let's have the note.
The messenger lowered his arm slowly and extended the parchment.
The plans have changed, Sir Sparhawk, he said politely.
Astonishing.
Barrett opened the parchment and gently took out the lock of identifying hair.
This is only about the third time. You fellows seem to be having some difficulty making up your minds.
He looked at the parchment.
That's accommodating. Somebody even drew a map this time.
The village isn't really very well known, the Domishman explained. It's a tiny place that wouldn't even be there if it weren't for the slave trade. You're a very good messenger, friend, Khalad told him. Would you like to carry a word back to Krager for me?
I'll try, young master.
Good. Tell him that I'm coming after him. He should probably start looking back over his shoulder, because no matter how this turns out, one day I'll be there.
The Domishman swallowed hard.
I'll tell him, young master.
I'd appreciate it.
The messenger carefully backed his horse off a few yards, and then rode back to rejoin his Arjunai escort.
Well?
Khalad asked.
Vigayo, over in Semeska.
It's not much of a town.
You've been there?
Briefly. Belium took us there by mistake when Sparhawk was practicing with it.
How far is it from here?
About 100 leagues. It's in the right direction, though. Afliel said that Zelasta's taking the queen to Sirga, so Vigayo's got to be closer than Arjun. Pass the word, Barrett. Tell Afliel that we'll start out first thing in the morning. Then you can come and help me cut up this deer. It's 10 days to Vigayo, so we're probably going to need the meat.
He has been there,
Zanisha told them.
His memories of the hidden city are vivid, but his recollection of the route is imprecise. I could glean no more than disconnected impressions of the journey. His madness hath bereft his thought of coherence, and his mind doth flit from reality to illusion and back, without purpose or direction.
I'd say we got us a problem, Calidor drawled. Old Krager, he don't know the way on account of he was too drunk to pay attention when Zelasta was a-talking about how to get to Sirga. And Scorpus too crazy to remember how he got there.
His eyes narrowed, and he discarded the dialect.
What about Cezada? He asked Zanisha.
She shuddered.
It is not madness nor drunkenness which doth bar my way into the thought of Cezada of Issos, she replied in a voice filled with revulsion. Deeply hath he reached into the darkness that was Azash, and the creatures of the netherworld have possessed him so utterly that his thought is no longer human. His spells at first did in some measure control those horrid demons, but then he did summon Clell, and in that act was all unloosed. Prithee, do not send me again into that seething chaos. He doth indeed know a route to Sirga, but we could in no wise follow that path, for it doth lie through the realm of flame and darkness and unspeakable horror.
That more or less exhausts the possibilities of this place, then, doesn't it? They all turned around quickly at the sound of the familiar voice. The child goddess sat demurely on a window ledge, holding her pipes in her hands.
Is this wise, divine one?
Bevier asked her. Won't our enemies sense your presence?
There's no one left here who can do that, Bevier, she replied. Zelasta's gone. I just stopped by to tell you that Barrett received new instructions. He and Khalad are going to Vigayo, a village just on the other side of the Senescan border. As soon as you're ready, I'll take you there.
What good will that do? Kalkin asked.
I need to get Zanisha close to the next messenger, she replied. Sirg is completely concealed, even for me. There's a key to that illusion, and that's what we have to find. Without that key, we could all grow old wandering around out in that wasteland and still not find the city.
I suppose you're right, Sparhawk conceded. He looked directly at her. Can you arrange another meeting? We're getting close to the end of this, and I need to talk with the others, Vanyan and Bergsten in particular, and probably with Betwana and Kring as well. We've got armies at our disposal, but they won't be much use if they're running off in three different directions or attacking Sirga piecemeal. We've got a general idea of where the place is, and I'd like to put a ring of steel around it. But I don't want anybody to go blundering in there until we get Elana and Aileen safely out.
You're going to get me in trouble, Sparhawk, she said tartly. Do you have any idea of the kinds of promises I'll have to make to get permission for that kind of gathering? And I'll have to keep all those promises, too.
It's really very important, Afriel.
She stuck her tongue out at him, and then she wavered and vanished.
Domi Tikumi sent orders, Your Reverence, the shaved-headed Paloi advised Patriarch Bergsten when they met in the churchman's tent just outside the town of Pella in central Astel. We're to provide whatever assistance we can.
Your Domi's a good man, friend Daya, the armored Patriarch replied.
His orders stirred up a hornet's nest, Daya said wryly. The idea of an alliance with the church knights set off a theological debate that went on for days. Most people here in Astel believe that the church knights were born and raised in hell. A fair number of the debaters are currently taking the matter up with God in person.
I gather that religious disputes among the Paloi are quite spirited.
Oh, yes, Daya agreed. The message from Archimandrite Monsol helped to quiet things, though. Paloi religious thought isn't really all that profound, Your Reverence. We trust God and leave the theology to the churchmen. If the Archimandrite approves, that's good enough for us. If he's wrong, he's the one who'll burn in hell for it.
How far is it from here to Sinestra? Bergsten asked him.
About 175 leagues, Your Reverence.
3 weeks, Bergsten muttered sourly. Well, there's not much we can do about that, I suppose. We'll start out first thing in the morning. Tell your men to get some sleep, friend Daya. It's probably going to be in short supply for the next month or so. Bergsten.
The voice crooning his name was light and musical. The Thalesian patriarch sat up quickly, reaching for his axe.
Oh, don't do that, Bergsten. I'm not going to hurt you.
Who's there?
He demanded, fumbling for his candle and his flint and steel.
Here.
A small hand emerged from the darkness with a tongue of flame dancing on its palm. Bergsten blinked. His midnight visitor was a little girl. Styric, he guessed. She was a beautiful child, with long hair and large eyes as dark as night. Bergsten's hands started to tremble.
You're Afriel, aren't you? He choked.
Keen observation, Your Grace. Sparhawk wants to see you.
He drew back from this personage that standard church doctrine told him did not, could not, exist.
You're being silly, Your Grace, she told him. You know that I couldn't even be talking to you if I didn't have permission from your god, don't you? I can't even come near you without permission.
Well, theoretically, he reluctantly conceded, you could be a demon, though, and the rules don't apply to them.
Do I look like a demon?
Appearance and reality are two different things, he insisted.
She looked into his eyes and pronounced the true name of the Aline god, one of the most closely kept secrets of the church.
A demon couldn't say that name, could it, Your Grace?
Well, I suppose not.
We'll get along well, Bergsten.
She smiled, kissing him lightly on the cheek.
Wurzel would have argued that point for weeks. Leave your axe here, please. Steel makes my flesh crawl.
Where are we going?
To meet with Sparhawk. I already told you that.
Is it far?
Not really.
She smiled, opening the tent flap. It was still night in Pella, but it was broad daylight beyond the tent flap. A strange sort of daylight.
A pristine white beach stretched down to a sapphire sea, all under a rainbow-colored sky, and a small green ayat, surmounted by a gleaming alabaster temple, rose from that incredibly blue sea about a half mile from the beach.
"What place is this?" Bergston asked,
poking his head out of the tent and looking around in amazement.
"I suppose you could call it heaven, Your Grace,"
the child goddess replied, blowing out the flame dancing on her palm.
"It's mine, anyway. There are others, but this one's mine." "Where is it?" "Everywhere and anywhere. All the heavens are every place all at once. So are all the hells, of course, but that's another story. Shall we go?"
Chapter 21 Cords of Neelan was the perfect man. That realization had not come easily to the devout Edomishman. It had only been after extended soul-searching and a meticulous examination of the sacred texts of his faith that he had arrived at the inescapable conclusion. He was perfect. He obeyed all of God's commandments. He did what he was supposed to do, and he did not do the things that were forbidden. Isn't that what perfection is all about? It was a comfort to be perfect, but Cords was not one to rest on his laurels. Now that he had achieved perfection in the eyes of God, it was time to turn his attention to the faults of his neighbors. Sinners, however, seldom sin openly, so Cords was obliged to resort to subterfuge. He peered through windows late at night. He eavesdropped on private conversations, and when his sinful neighbors cleverly concealed their wrongdoing from him, he imagined the sins they might be committing. The Sabbath was a very special day for Cords, but not for the sermons. After all, what need had a perfect man for sermons? It was on the Sabbath that he was able to rise to his feet and denounce the sins of his neighbors, both the sins they had committed and the sins they might be committing. He probably irritated the devil. God knows he irritated his neighbors. But then a crisis had arisen in Edom, the debauched and heretical Church of Kyrellos, after 2 eons of plotting and scheming, was finally preparing to make her move against the righteous. The church knights were on the march, and horrors beyond imagining marched with them. Cords was among the first to enlist in Lebal's army. The perfect man abandoned his neighbors to their sinful ways to join a holier cause. He became Lebal's most trusted messenger, killing horses by the dozen as he rushed about the Aline kingdoms of Western Tomali, carrying the dispatches so vital to the cause. On this particular day, Cords was flogging his exhausted horse southward toward the corrupt cities of southern Daconia, cesspools of sin and licentiousness, if the truth were to be known, where the citizens not only did not know that they were sinners, they did not even care. Worse yet, an obscure and probably heretical tradition of the Dacite Church prevented laymen from speaking aloud during Sabbath services. Thus, God's very own spokesman, the perfect man, was not permitted to expose and denounce the sins he saw all around him. The frustration of it sometimes made him want to scream. He had been riding hard for the past week, and he was very tired. Thus it was with some relief that he finally crested the hill that overlooked the port city of Melek. Then all thoughts of the sins of others vanished. Cords reined in his staggering horse and gaped in horror at what he saw. There, on a sea sparkling in the winter sun, was a vast armada, ships beyond counting, sailing majestically down the coast under the red and gold banners of the Church of Kyrellos. The perfect man was so overcome with horror that he did not even hear the plaintive sound of a shepherd's rude pipe playing a styric air in a minor key somewhere off to his left. He gaped for a time at his worst nightmare, and then he desperately drove his spurs into his horse's flanks, rushing to spread the alarm. General Sarada was the younger brother of Duke Melanus, and he commanded the rebel forces in Panamdia. King Rakia had so arranged it that most of Scarpa's generals were Arjunai. Sarada knew that there were risks involved, but the younger sons of noble families were obliged to take risks if they wanted to get ahead in the world. For them, rank and position had to be won. Sarada had endured the years of association with the crazy bastard son of a tavern wench and the discomfort of camping out in the jungle, waiting for his chance. And now it had come. The madman in the Taos had finally sent the order to march. The campaign had begun. There was no sleep in Panamdia that night, the preparations for the march went on through the hours of darkness, and the undisciplined rabble Sarada commanded was incapable of doing anything quietly. The general spent the night poring over his maps. The strategy was sound. He was forced to admit that. He was to join forces with Scarpa and the other rebels near Durrell. Then they would march north to the Tamil Mountains to be reinforced by Seneskans. From there, they would march on Tosa in preparation for the final assault on Mathurian. General Sarada's own strategy was much simpler. Scarpa would crush any resistance at Tosa, but he would not live to see the gleaming domes of the imperial capital. Sarada smiled thinly and patted the little vial of poison he carried in his inside pocket. The army would capture Mathurian, but it would be General Sarada who would lead the final assault and personally run his sword through Emperor Sarabian. The younger brother of Duke Melanus expected an earldom, at the very least, to come out of this campaign. The door banged open, and his adjutant burst into the room, his eyes starting from his head and his face a pasty white.
"Good God, my general!"
he shrieked.
"What do you think you're doing?"
Sarada demanded.
"How dare you? I'll have you flogged for this." "We're being attacked, my general."
Sarada could hear the squeals of terror now. He rose quickly and went out the door. It was not yet daylight, and a clinging mist had crept out of the tangled forest to blur the ruined walls and houses of Panambia. There were fires and flaring torches pushing back the darkness with their ruddy light, but there were other lights in the weed-choked streets as well, pale, cold lights that did not burn or flicker. Creatures of light, pale as wandering moons, stalked the streets of Panambia. The general's heart filled with terror. It was impossible. The Shining Ones were a myth. There were no such creatures. Sarada shook off his fright and drew his sword.
"Stand fast,"
he roared at his demoralized men.
"Form up. Pikemen to the front."
He bulled his way into the milling mob of terrified troops, flailing about him with the flat of his sword.
"Form up! Make a line!"
But there was no rationality nor fear of authority in the panic-stricken faces of his poorly trained men. The screaming mob simply diverged and bypassed him on either side. He ran at them again, swinging great strokes with his sword, cutting down his own men. He was so desperate to restore order that he did not even feel the knife stroke that went in just below his ribs on the left side. He could not even understand why his knees buckled, or why he fell under the trampling feet of his soldiers as they fled screaming into the trackless forest.
"Are you sure this map's accurate, Tinian?" Patriarch Bergston demanded, peering at the miniature world under his feet.
"It's the most accurate map you'll ever see, Your Grace," Tinian assured him. "Blockov cast the spell, and the troll gods put their hands into the ground and felt the shape of the continent. This is it, down to the last tree and bush. Everything's here."
"Except for Sirga, Tinian Knight," Engessa amended.
The Aton general was completely healed now, and he looked as fit as ever. His face, however, was troubled. His queen had greeted him almost abruptly when she had first arrived, and she was quite obviously avoiding him. Sophrenia was seated on one of the benches in Aphriel's alabaster temple, with the rainbow light from the impossible sky playing over her face.
"We'd hoped that Shli might be able to feel Sirga when he recreated the continent, Your Grace," she said. "But Sirgan's illusion seems to be absolute. Not even a trollish spell can break it." "What's the best guess we can come up with?" Bergston asked.
Aphriel walked lightly across the tiny world Blockov had conjured up for them. She stepped over the minuscule city of Sinestra and continued south to a mountainous region in the center of the desert.
"It used to be somewhere in this general vicinity," she said, gesturing vaguely over the mountains.
"Used to be?"
Bergston asked her sharply. She shrugged.
"Sometimes we move things."
"Whole cities?"
"It's possible, but it's a reflection of bad planning."
Bergston shuddered and began marking off distances on the miniature continent with a long piece of string.
"I'm up here at Pella," he told them, pointing at a spot in central Astel. "That's almost 300 leagues from the general vicinity of Sirga, and I'll have to stop to capture Sinestra along the way. The rest of you are much closer, so you're going to have to hold off a bit if we all want to get there at approximately the same time."
Aphriel shrugged.
"I'll tamper," she said.
Bergston gave her a puzzled look. Divine Afriel has ways of compressing time and distance, Your Grace, Sparhawk explained. She can...
I don't want to hear about it, Sparhawk, Brigston said sharply, putting his hands over his ears. You've already put my soul in danger just by bringing me here. Please don't make it any worse by telling me things I don't need to know about.
Whatever you say, Your Grace, Sparhawk agreed. Emban was pacing around the cluster of upthrusting mountains in the center of the Senescan Desert.
We're all going to be converging on these mountains, he said. I'm no expert, but wouldn't our best move be just to stop in the foothills and wait until everyone's in place before we make the final assault?
No, Your Grace, Vanyan said firmly. Let's stay out a bit from the foothills, at least a day's ride. If we run into Klell's creatures, we'll need room to maneuver. I want a lot of flat ground around me when that happens.
The fat little churchman shrugged. You're the soldier, Vanyan. He pointed toward the south. There's our weakness, he said. We've got a good concentration of forces coming out of the east, the northeast, and the north. But we don't have anybody covering the south.
Or the west, Sarabian added.
I'll cover the west, Your Majesty, Brigston told him. I can position my knights and the Paloi to block off that entire quadrant.
That still leaves the south, Emban mused. It's already been taken care of, Emban, Afriel assured him. Stragan's been spinning stories about a vast church fleet off the southern coast, and I've been weaving illusions to back him up. How long is it going to take the trolls to get into position north of Jubé, Olaf?
Just as long as it takes to persuade the troll gods that we need their children there instead of in the Tommel Mountains, the big Salesian replied. A day or so, probably. Once they're convinced, they'll put their children into no time. If we didn't have to stop now and then to feed the trolls, we could be in Jubé before you could even blink. If I knew where Sirga was, I could have 1,500 trolls on the doorstep by morning.
There's no need to rush.
The child goddess looked around with steely eyes.
Nobody, and I mean nobody, is going to move on Sirga until I know that Elana and Aileen are safe. If I have to, I can keep you running around in circles out there in that desert for generations. So don't try to get creative on me.
Is the Queen of Alenia so very important to you, Divine One?
Petwana asked mildly.
War is hard, and we must accept our losses.
It's a personal matter, Betwana, Afriel said shortly. These are your positions.
She gestured over the miniature continent.
Brixton will come in from the north and west to cover that side of the city. Olaf, Tinian, and Blockus will bring the trolls down from Jubé and join with Betwana's Aetons on their left flank. Vanyan will come in from the east and be joined on his left by Kring and the Paloi. Stragan's persuaded that disgusting Dacite in Varessa that there are a million or so church knights landing on the coast around Varel and Kaftal, and that should divert most of the armies of Seneska. We'll all converge on Sirga. There are some discrepancies in the distances, but I'll take care of those. When the time comes, you will all be in place, even if I have to pick you up one by one and carry you. She stopped abruptly. What is your problem, Brigston? Don't laugh at me, or I'll take you by the nose and shake you.
I wasn't laughing, Divine One, he assured her. I was only smiling in approval. Where did you learn so much about strategy and tactics?
I've been watching you, Alines, make war since shortly after you discovered fire, Your Grace. I was bound to learn a few of the tricks of the trade.
She turned suddenly on Blockus.
What?
She asked irritably and trollish.
Ulat has said to me what you have said, child goddess. Why are we doing this?
To punish the wicked ones, priest of the troll gods.
What? Sparhawk said to Ulat in stunned amazement. What did she call him?
Oh, Ulat said mildly. Didn't you know? Our shaggy friend has a certain eminence.
They actually have priests?
Of course. Doesn't everybody? It is good to punish the wicked ones who have taken Annika's mate away,
Blockus was saying.
But do we need to take so many? Quadge will punish the wicked ones. This is the season of Shli, and we should be following the way of the hunt. The young must be fed or they will die, and that is not a good thing.
Oh, dear, Afriel murmured. What's happening here, Sir Olaf?
Sarabian asked.
The trolls are hunters, Your Majesty,
Ulof explained,
not warriors. They have no real understanding of warfare. They eat what they kill.
Sarabian shuddered.
It is very moral, Your Majesty, Ulof pointed out. From a troll's point of view, wasting the meat is criminal.
Aphriel was squinting at the priest of the troll gods.
It is a good thing to do that which follows the way of the hunt and punishes the wicked ones at the same time, she said. If we hunt this way, we will cause hurt to the wicked ones and bring much meat to the young during the season of Shui.
Blockus considered that.
The hunts of the Man-Things are not simple, he said dubiously, but it is my thought that the hunts of the God-Things are even more not simple.
He reflected on it.
It is good, though. A hunt that gathers more than meat is a good hunt. You hunt very well, child goddess. Sometime we might take eat together and talk of old hunts. It is good to do this. It makes packmates closer so that they hunt together better.
It would make me glad if we did this, Blockus.
Then we will do it. I will kill a dog for us to eat. Dog is even more good to eat than pig.
Aphriel made a slight gagging sound.
Will it cause anger to you if I speak to our packmates in bird noises, Blockus?
Sparhawk stepped in.
It will soon be time for the hunt to begin, and all must be made ready.
It will not cause anger to me, Annika. Ulot can say to me what you are saying.
All right, then, Sparhawk said to the rest of them. We all know how we're going to converge on Sirga, but there are several of us who have to go in first. Please hold off on your attack until we're in position. Don't crowd us by trampling on our heels.
Who are you taking in with you, Sparhawk?
Vanyan asked.
Calton, Bevier, Talon, Zanisha, and Mirtai.
I don't quite...
Sparhawk held up one hand.
Aphriel made the choices, my lord, he said. If there are any objections, take them up with her.
You have to have those people with you, Sparhawk, Aphriel explained patiently. If you don't, you'll fail.
Whatever you say, Divine One, he surrendered.
You'll be out in front of Barret and me, then?
Khalad asked. Sparhawk nodded.
The people on the other side will expect us to trail along behind you. If we're in front, it might confuse them. At least, that's what we're hoping.
Aphriel will take us directly to Vigayo, and we'll nose around a bit. If the fellow with the next message is already there, Zanisha should be able to pick up your next destination. Sooner or later, somebody's going to have to give you the key to the illusion that's hiding Sirga, and that's the one piece of information we have to have. Once we've got that, the rest is easy.
I like his definition of easy, Kalidor murmured to Stragan.
Emban jotted another note on his inevitable list. Then he cleared his throat.
Must you, Emban?
Bergston sighed.
It helps me to think, Bergston, and it makes sure that we haven't left anything out. If it bores you so much, don't listen.
The Man-Things talk much when they decide how they will hunt, Ulot,
Blockus complained.
It is the nature of the Man-Things to do this.
It is because the hunts of the Man-Things are too much not simple. It is my thought that their hunts are not simple because they do not eat the ones they kill. They hunt and kill for reasons which I do not understand. It is my thought that this thing the Man-Things call war is a very great wickedness.
It is not in our thought to cause anger to the priest of the troll gods,
Patriarch Bergston said in flawless trollish.
The thing which the Man-Things call war is like the thing which happens when two troll packs come to hunt on the same range.
Blockus considered that. Then he grunted as comprehension came over his shaggy face.
Now it is clear to me, he said. This thing the Man-Things call war is like the hunting of thought. That is why it is not simple. But you still talk much.
The troll squinted at Emban.
That one is the worst, he added. His mind belly is as big as his belly belly.
What did he say? Emban asked curiously.
It wouldn't translate very well, Your Grace, Ulof replied blandly.
Patriarch Emban gave him a slightly suspicious look, and then meticulously laid out their deployment once again, checking items off his list as he went. When he had finished, he looked around.
Can anybody think of anything else?
Perhaps,
Sophronia said, frowning slightly.
Our enemies know that Barrett's not really Sparhawk, but they're going to think that Sparhawk won't have any choice but to follow along behind. It might help to confirm that belief. I think I know a way to duplicate the sound and sense of Velium. If it works, our enemies will think that Sparhawk's somewhere in the column of night Vanyan's going to lead out into the desert. They'll concentrate on us rather than looking for him.
You're putting yourself in danger, Sophronia, Afriel objected.
There's nothing particularly new about that,
Sophronia smiled.
And when you consider what we're trying to do, no place is really safe.
Is that it, then?
N'Gessa asked, standing up.
Probably, friend N'Gessa, Kring replied. Except for the hour or so, we'll all spend telling each other to be careful.
N'Gessa squared his shoulders, turned, and faced his queen directly.
What are your orders, Betwana Queen?
He asked her with military formality. She drew herself up with a regal stiffness.
It is our instruction that you return with us to Sarna, N'Gessa Aton. There you will resume command of our armies.
It shall be as you say, Betwana Queen.
Directly upon our return, you will send runners to my husband, the king. Tell him that there is no longer a threat to Tosa. The Shining Ones will deal with Scarpa.
He nodded stiffly.
Further tell him that I have need of his forces in Sarna. That is where we will prepare for the main battle, and he should be there to take command.
She paused.
This is not because we are dissatisfied with your leadership, N'Gessa Aton, but Andril is the king. You have served well. The royal house of Aton is grateful.
It is my duty, Betwana Queen,
he replied, clashing his fist against his breastplate in salute.
No gratitude is necessary.
Oh, dear,
Afriel murmured.
What's wrong?
Sophronia asked her.
Nothing.
Chapter 22
It's definitely Chocol and Torelius Arabian,
Elisun insisted several days later.
Chocol's more or less running things. She's older and shrewder. The strangers usually go directly to her. They talk privately for a while, and then she sends for Torelia. They weren't really all that fond of each other before, but now they've got their heads together all the time.
They're probably getting orders from home, Sarabian mused. King Jalua of Seneska is Chocol's brother, and Torelia is the daughter of King Rakia of Arjuna. Can you get any sense at all of what they might be up to? She shook her head.
It's too early.
Early?
Women's politics again. We're more devious than men. Chocol will want everything in place before she starts to form other alliances. She's got Torelia under control, but she's not quite ready to start trying to expand yet.
You're sure that Torelia's the subordinate one? She nodded.
Chocol's servants are lording it over hers. That's the first sign of dominance in the women's palace. Sirona's servants are all insufferable because she's the first wife, and we're all subordinate to her. Except for Lyatris, of course.
Of course, Sarabian smiled. No one in his right mind is impertinent to Lyatris. Has she killed anybody lately?
Not since she butchered Sierona's footman last year.
There's a thought. Should we bring Lyatris into this? Elisun shook her head.
Maybe later, but not at this stage. Aetana Lyatris is too direct. If I approached her with this, she'd simply kill Chocol and Torelia. Let's wait until Chocol approaches me before we involve Lyatris.
Are you sure Chocol will approach you?
It's almost certain. My servants have greater freedom of movement than hers, because of my social activities.
That's a delicate way to put it.
You knew I was a Valesian when you married me, Sarabian, and you know about our customs. That's why my servants have the run of the compound. It's always been a tradition.
He sighed. How many are there currently, Elisun?
None, actually.
She smiled at him.
You don't really understand, do you, Sarabian? The biggest part of the fun of those little adventures has always been the intrigue, and I'm getting plenty of that playing politics.
Aren't you feeling a little deprived?
I can endure it.
She shrugged.
And if I get desperate, I always have you to fall back on, don't I?
and she gave him an arch little smile.
"Well, sir, Master Valish," Calidore drawled, leaning back in his chair in the cluttered loft. "Old Vimer here, he done told me that you're a-willing to pay good money for information, and he sort of figured as how you might want to hear about the stuff I've seen in Southwest Aton for your very own self."
"You two have known each other for quite some time, then?" Valish asked.
"Oh, gorsh, yes, Master Valish. Me and Vimer goes way back. We was all together during that fracas in Mithurian. Him and me and Fran and Reldon, along with a couple others, when the fellers from Interior come a-bustin' in on us. They was hull bunches of excitement that night, let me tell you. Anyway, after we shuck off the police, we all split up and scattered to the winds. 'Tain't a real good idea to stay all bunched up when you're a-runnin' from the law."
Stragan sat back from the table out of the circle of light from the single candle, carefully watching Valish's face. Calidore had just arrived to replace Sparhawk and Talon in the ongoing deception of Valish, and Stragan was once again impressed by how smooth his friend really was. Valish seemed lulled by the easy, folksy charm of Calidore's dialect. Stragan despised the slovenly speech, but he was forced to admit its utility. It always seemed so genuine, so innocently artless.
"Where is Fran, anyway?" Valish asked.
"Him and Reldon took off about a week ago."
Calidore shrugged.
"I happened to stop off in the tavern up in Delo whilst I was a-comin' on down here, and they was a feller what had policemen wrote all over him who was describin' old Fran and the boy right down to the warts. Soon's I got here, I told them about it, and they figured that it might just be time to move on. Anyhow, Vimer here says as how you're interested in what's a-goin' on here and thar. And I've seen a few things after we all got run out of Mithurian that he's a-thankin' might be worth something to you."
"I'll certainly listen, Ezek."
Valish raised his head sharply as the comatose Ogorajan began to mumble in his sleep.
"Is he all right?" Stragan asked.
"It's nothing," Valish said shortly. "He does that all the time. Go ahead, Ezek."
"Well, sir, she was a couple weeks ago, I guess, and I was a-hot-footin' it across Aton, figurin' to make my way on across Estelle to Darso's, on account of the law being hot on my heels and all. I was a-comin' on down out in the mountings when I pulled up short, 'cause I've seen more gol-dang Atons than I thought they was in the whole world. I mean, they went on for miles. They was multitudes of them big rascals, all geared up for war and a-lookin' real mean and unfriendly-like."
"The entire Aton army?" Valish exclaimed.
"It looked to me more like a general migration of the whole dang race, Master Valish. You ain't never seen so many of 'em."
"Where exactly were they?" Valish asked excitedly.
"Well, sir, close as I could make out, they was right close to the Seneskan border, up far close by a little town called Jube. If and you happen to have a map handy, I could point out the exact spot for you."
Calidore squinted at the Dacite.
"What would you say this information's worth, Master Valish?"
Valish didn't even hesitate when he reached for his purse.
"It was very strange, Domi Takumi," Kring told his friend as they rode at the head of their masked tribesmen out into the Seneskan Desert the morning after the conference on Afriel's Island.
"The child goddess said that we were all dreaming, but everything seemed so real. I could actually smell the flowers in the grass. I've never smelled anything in a dream before."
Takumi looked dubious.
"Are you sure it wasn't heresy to go there, Domi Kring?"
Kring laughed wryly.
"Well, if it was, I was in good company. Patriarch Emban was there, and so was Patriarch Bergston. Anyway, you and I are supposed to continue making these raids into Seneska. Then we're supposed to go ahead and ride in toward those mountains out in the middle of the desert. We're hoping that Prince Sparhawk will have pinpointed the exact location of Sirga by the time we get there."
One of the scouts who had been ranging the burnt brown desert ahead came galloping back. "Domi Takumi," he said as he reined in, "we've found them."
"Where?"
Takumi demanded. "There's a dry watercourse about 2 miles ahead, Domi. They're crouched down in there. I'd say they're planning to ambush us.
What sort of soldiers are they? Kring asked.
There was Senescan cavalry, and more of those big ones with the steel masks that we've been running to death lately. There was some other infantry as well, but I didn't recognize them.
Breastplates, short kirtles, helmets with high crests and big round shields?
Those are the ones, Domi Kring. Kring rubbed one hand across his shaved scalp.
How wide is the water course?
He asked. 50 paces or so, Domi.
Crooked, fairly deep?
The scout nodded.
It's an ambush, all right,
Kring said.
The cavalry probably intends to let us see them and then retreat into the gully. If we follow them, we'll run right into the infantry. We've been running Klell's soldiers to death in open country, so they want to get us into tight quarters.
What do we do? Takumi asked.
We stay out of that stream bed, friend Takumi. Send out flankers to cut off their cavalry after they ride out. We'll slaughter them, and that should bring Klell's soldiers out into the open.
What about the seer guy? Are they more of those ones out of the past that we keep coming across?
I don't think so. This is inside the borders of Seneska, so they're probably live ones from Sirga itself.
Kring stopped suddenly, and a slow grin crossed his face.
I just thought of something. Send out your flankers, friend Takumi. Give me some time to think my way through this.
That's a particularly nasty grin there, friend Kring.
I'm a particularly nasty fellow sometimes, friend Takumi,
Kring replied, his grin growing even wider.
Slavers,
Mirtai said shortly after she had peered down the rocky hill at the column creeping slowly across the barren brown gravel toward the village clustered around the oasis. The almost instantaneous change from the humidity of the Arjunai jungle to the arid Seneskan desert had given Sparhawk a slight headache.
How can you tell at this distance?
Sevier asked her.
Those hooded black robes, she replied, peering again over the boulder which concealed them. Slavers wear them when they come into Seneska, so that the local authorities won't interfere with them. Seneska's about the only place left where slavery's openly legal. The other kingdoms frown on it.
There's a thought, Sparhawk, Sevier said. If we could get our hands on some of those black robes, we'd be able to move around out in the desert without attracting attention.
We don't look very much like Arjunai, Bevier, Carlton objected.
We don't have to, Talon told him. From what I heard back in Baressa, there are bands of raiders out in the desert who ambush the caravans in order to steal the slaves. So the Arjunai slavers hire lots of fighting men of all races to help protect the merchandise.
Oh, Carlton said. I wonder where we could lay our hands on black robes.
I see 100 or so of them right out there, Sevier said, pointing at the caravan. Aline,
Zenisha sighed, rolling her eyes upward. End of Side 8. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.